Here's the thing. It's amazing what can get your mind rolling on the family histories, you know? There's so many ways. She's got a marvelous story to tell us today about going home. And I have a feeling that you have a few of your own.
Well,
here is a set of, this is from the families. This is my family tree. This is an easy thing. And you could even use this with kids. At least, you know, junior high, high school kids. And hi, come on in. And this is a collection of handouts that I've made over the years for a variety of classes and workshops that I have taught. And I just bunched them all together and decided to give them, and I think you already have these, don't you, Clary? You don't? Okay. Well then, I'm going to give you some. Now, where's my family tree?
Behind you on the right.
All right.
Extra or not?
Well, this is going to get duplicated.
Oh, okay.
And I had two still, and you didn't pick any up either, huh? Okay. Just a minute now. I have a whole bunch of stuff that I have.
Here you go. Oh, these are neat.
Thank you.
Mary?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you. And this is for you. And this is for you.
That's what extra one?
But I'll give you the family. The only one I don't have an extra of is this family story tree, so I'll get a couple more made up before we leave today. But I thought while we were waiting for people to gather, we could look at these handouts a minute, see if they bring any questions to mind. Now, there's one in particular that I want to draw your attention to. It's on the back of Storytelling Pointers from our session at Mount Carmel, 2007. Turn it around, and you see something called Characteristics of a Creative Person. Now, you know how popular affirmations are, and people, you know, they're always talking about affirmation. Well, frankly, for me, this is the most powerful set of affirmations I ever received. Mm. And I share it with all of you because you're here in storytelling, and this is a creative process. So my dad sent this to me, this is a little family history, back in the early 1980s, when I decided to move forward with storytelling as my calling. I'd been an actress and a teacher, and I had done storytelling all along as well, but I had never thought of it as a calling or a vocation, something that I would try to make a living from, until I got divorced. And at that point, I had to do some serious work, a la Romans, whatever that was we were studying today, and figure out, well, how can I serve? I have two daughters to raise, I have to make a living, and I have this experience in theater, and I have this experience in education. And neither one of them really fit what I felt was my top priority at the time, raising these two daughters. And so, how was I going to do it? I wanted to be able to be flexible, to be able to be home if they were sick, or be able to be around when they came home from school, that kind of thing. And above all, I did not want to be burned out with kids all day long, and now I have my children, you know?
How old were your girl?
Miranda was 5 going on 6, and Allie was 9 going on 10. And so, I started started thinking about it, I'd taken a class called What Color Is Your Parachute?
Oh, yes.
And I'd done some you know about that too?
My husband did
that too. Midlife career changes. I did this before, actually, I was divorced while I was still married. And it was my former husband who suggested that I take the class. Having said that, and having paid for the class, he was very disappointed in the result.
Oh, wow. You guys didn't have the same color of parachute, huh?
And one of his biggest disappointments in our marriage was, I thought I'd marry a school teacher. That was a bitter disappointment. He felt I had cheated him and betrayed his trust because he was not a school teacher. I'm going to have a horrible time for a few days. I mean, it's just going to be awful because of the air. Yep. We even have red alerts now in Minneapolis. But we do have them, and it's unforgivable in my point of view because we have no mountains. We're not L.A. We're not Seattle. There's nothing. It's just an open plain, but apparently we have more highways than L.A. now. Anyway, wow. Back to the subject. This was I didn't even know how bad I felt about myself. And then my dad said, well, you know, if you're working with creative people, you should definitely check out this thing from Kaiser Aluminum. Found in Kaiser Aluminum. He sent it to me with something that was inside of a training book.
Was supporting you. He was adding the layers back on that your husband had you doing.
Well, he didn't even know it, you know, because I hadn't shared, and because I couldn't, because I didn't even know it. You know, I really didn't know that I suffered from insecurity because I was a creative person. I, for example, thought that I was kind of a slow student because I always had to do everything my own way, and so I worked forever. I was getting my papers in last. And sure enough, it was part of being creative that I was making my own solutions to problems or doing it. And I wasn't good at following directions. And, you know, there were lots of things I didn't do right. So here I am. And of course, I was often not on time. You know, again, these are all things that happen to people who are creative. And let us give ourselves the power of knowing what we are, and that this comes with it, the territory. And it is not bad. It is just different. You know? It's a cultural difference, shall we say. So I found this empowering, and then later I worked with children who were in the gifted and talented program, and I was extremely shocked to discover most of them were just the best students in the world. They followed directions so well. And I realized the teachers were not sending me the people I was supposed to be addressing. They were sending me
good readers. Yeah.
The best students in the class.
The good best readers.
Yeah. And the ones that were quick at math. Well, follow directions, you know, and that was difficult for me, that I had a conflict in the school that went beyond the teachers and the principals. It went even as far as the parents, because of course the parents had their identity wrapped up in their children too. So it was an insight that wasn't, like we were talking about the gift of grace, and that, you know, Jesus coming as life abundant, you know. From my family history, I tell you a story. My dad went to prison camp, a dedicated radical. I'm not kidding. He said he thought everybody should drink. As far as he was concerned, you know, that was just frivolous and not necessary. And there was too much suffering in the world, and we needed to dedicate ourselves to bringing up. And redistributing the wealth was one of the most important things that we could do as Christians. After all, were the early Christians doing that? Yes, they were. So anyway, they got into prison camp, and it changed.
His own prison.
It
camp.
Changed
when
his,
he was interned. You mean.
Yes.
Yeah.
It changed his theology. When he got out of prison camp, he said, "I will never allow anyone that I know think that they are helping the poor of the world by depriving themselves of good things to eat and the good things of life, you know." He says that is wrong. It didn't help us in prison camp, and we were praying that all of our loved ones at home would celebrate Thanksgiving and not go without, because we had to.
Yeah.
That was, you know, that, and so his message changed. His message changed. Instead of carrying the cross with Jesus, it was enjoying life abundant because Jesus had already carried and was carrying the cross. And that was the message. And it was because we have so much that we can share, not because they have little, and what little we have, we shouldn't have either. No. And it's just a different way of looking at the same thing, but it was a radical change. Now here's something he gave to my mom the last Christmas. that we had. It was a really hard Christmas, 1944. Everyone knew that something was coming to an end. Nobody knew yet if we were going to survive it. And that Christmas, we were getting pretty weak, losing a lot of weight, and pretty sure that we weren't going to be in that place much longer. We knew that the Japanese had plans for us, and we didn't know if we'd be executed out in the mountains somewhere, brought down to Manila for the final climax of our internment. We had no idea. We still believed the Americans were going to rescue us. Most of us did, but by now, we had not been hearing, the latest word, the Americans will be here in 3 weeks. You know, this went on for the first year. It was like every month we were told, the rumor mill got going, and, yes, we heard on the chart, right? Somebody told. Well, what to give Mother for Christmas? So he decided he was going to make her a book. And he went to all his friends, all her friends, and he asked that each of her friends in prison camp to write her a letter. Can you hear? That pounding's hard. We can go in. Okay. To write her a letter telling her what they imagined. What they imagined doing with her when they were liberated. And then he wrote a letter to her, too. A beautiful love letter. And all about their date, their first date when they got out. And it didn't end until Sunday morning when they had homemade cinnamon buns with butter, real butter. Hi.
Hi, I'm sorry.
It's so nice to see you. Should I recap the story, or do you want to tell it? Somebody, oral tradition, bring her up to speed. Where are we with this story?
This
you want to tell? Or you can tell.
No, go ahead.
Okay. I'm trying to remember why we're talking about it, but to be an oral historian or an oral storyteller, as Marin is, goes way back into the depths of who she is. Mm-hmm. And storytelling through the internment camp, especially, is a defining part of Marin and her family, her parents, and the final. Other, that her dad wanted to give her mom a lasting gift, which is a book made up of letters from all of her friends. That would
in prison camp.
In prison camp. That would define or would describe what, when they got out, what would they do together, the mom and her friend. So each person writes the letter as a gift. And the dad, her dad, wrote a beautiful letter of the date, their first date they will have when they're out. And it goes on, it sounds like from a Friday night, Saturday, and then Sunday morning with cinnamon buns with real butter. And
he called this
and then it comes
book,
back to her.
He called this book Mary's Book of Pleasures. And it's really it's just a family treasure.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. We love that book. And when Father died, one of my siblings printed it, Xeroxed it, and sent it to each of us. And then we tried to read Father's letter. We couldn't read it! It was we could read part of it. But he had such bad handwriting. So my niece was living with my mom at the time, and the two of them got together and deciphered it.
Oh,
so we got it now.
Oh,
apartment.
Well, and then that letter would have been such the biggest treasure of them all.
Oh, yes.
So it would have been touched many times, and the paper would have changed. And the ink would have been, or pencil.
Well, honestly, it was true to fashion. My parents have all kinds of stuff. They never threw anything out, but they couldn't find it either. So it was pretty safe from touching. Hadn't been fun until now.
Wow.
Yeah. And then we got it copied so it wouldn't be too... But I did bring it into the History Center thinking they might like to use it in the... in their new exhibit on the greatest generation, and they decided not to use it.
Where is
the
History Center?
In Minneapolis, the Minnesota Historical Society put up a big new exhibit, and it's called The Greatest Generation. Just a little pretentious.
I don't think so.
Don't you?
I think that was a remarkable group of people.
This is true.
It's not me. I'm a little younger than them, so I can say it. But I think they were a remarkable group of people.
The people who were how old during
World War II?
Depression.
So like,
from the Depression to
probably 1929 to 45.
Yeah, that were
a lot. Well, actually, through the boom years. They did it from the Depression, through the war, through the 50s.
Yeah.
And
it
were they adults all during the
Yes.
Yeah, that's
okay.
when they
that's
were adults.
Question.
They came to be adults. Most of them were born in the teens, or a few maybe in the early 20s.
Too. The old 7th, so forth.
Yeah, right. They also, anyone who was capable of fighting in World War II would be part of the Greatest Generation.
Okay. I was born in 23, so part of it.
You are the
greatest
generation.
Don't you think?
And
that's a good name for you.
Yeah, it surely is. It surely is. No, I don't mean to denigrate that group of people. They were remarkable. It's just that I think there were other generations that were also great at certain times, and so that brings up the question of, well, wasn't the generation that immigrated great? Didn't they have to stand up to a lot of
Civil War.
Horrible? The one during the Civil War, wasn't that great? No, there's a lot of great generations. But on the other hand, they were great. And there is no doubt in my mind or anyone's mind, they were great, except perhaps in their own minds. And that is what we're dealing with today, the best and the worst of times. And this war, like all wars, brings horrible, horrible memories. Memories of innocent deaths, memories of friends lost and unable to be rescued, and a post recovery that I've heard stories from, well, friend who just left the village told me when we were partnering, one of the stories that she told me was the story of her own true love during World War II, and they wrote each other daily, and he came back from World War II, and she didn't know the man.
Yeah.
They married, they had 4 children, but his entire personality had changed. He was cold. He was removed. He had no, he drank. He was an alcoholic. All of these were symptoms of a deeper. I want to say
angry.
Disease. Yeah. So, the worst of times, the best of times. But coming through these, life isn't easy. And so, what helps us get through these things? Does anybody have a...
Well, I would say in my case, the worst of times, but probably probably help me through was just a scripture passage that I discovered, which I read over and over and over, and so in my Bible that page is just about to fall out. And it was in dealing with the daughter and Jesus saying that the mother's faith is strong.
All right, now.
And
what?
So by just reading that over and over all the time, that's what brought me through. And then this is like a gift, because that's exactly what this daughter is.
Creative person.
And we tried to put her into the mold of
a
square
peg and a round hole.
Yeah. So this just explains her completely.
Well, this is all, I'm glad to hear all of this. This also goes to you. Now I'm going to get 1, 2, 3 family trees, if you want one of these family tree things. I'm going to get some more printed up. Yes, and again, the handles that help us, well, if we're gifted with a tradition like the one that I was born into it, some people are introduced to it later in their lives, but however we find this tradition, which is based in the Word, there are words in that Bible that can help us through the worst of times. And the promises, as well as Psalm 27, were terrific for my family. And every day since after that, I mean, I do believe now, I don't think my dad knew that he had post-traumatic stress. I mean, his hands shook much more after World War II. He always had a slight tremor, but, you know, and his parishioners would often say, why don't you prepare your sermons? Well, nobody worked harder on his sermons than my dad did, but he never used notes because his hands shook and the papers would rattle. So it made him a powerful proclaimer, a powerful preacher, because he didn't look down. He was always listening to you. And I remember as a little girl, 5 years old, when the first church we were in Natwalk, Wisconsin, I would march down, 5 years old, down the center aisle and sit in the front row because I wanted to hear every word my daddy said. Every word, because he was a great storyteller. And he could keep my attention, 5 years old. And I had such focus on him that I could see a halo around his head. I saw his aura. Isn't that something? And of course, that said, I mean, we were going through hard times, my dad and I, by then, because my little sister had been born. So I felt very rejected. Now, let me tell you something about stories about hard times. It's good to get, it's all right to be vulnerable, but like Emily Dickinson says, tell the truth, but tell it slant. In other words, you don't have to have true confessions. And in fact, it's better if you don't.
She must have been a PK.
She was a preacher's
kid.
Yeah. Actually, she was a president's kid, president of a college.
Oh, that's how I understood.
A religious college.
Yeah, it was
a
religious, that's right. Yeah.
Are you an Emily Dickinson fan?
I am. Yeah.
I have a friend who every time I talk to him, he recites Emily Dickinson.
Well, just a little, you know, something to remember. You don't have to be literal about your family history. I mean, you can protect yourself and your loved ones. Nobody needs to know every boil you carry. You know, it's not a comfortable thing for people. And so, that said, we also need to know how you get through hard times. And if we don't share the hard times, we are missing out on some of that exchange, that of empowerment. And so, you know, it's a creative tension. It's a creative problem to solve, how you are going to tell this story. Now, I haven't told many stories about my family history. Well, I maybe think I have, but I have somebody else. I think I haven't told it. So if you would like me to, before we pass the story stone.
It's part of our oral traditions.
Yes, our oral traditions. I don't know how to do this. Let's do the exercise first, because I want to be sure we get your stories done, and it's 11:30. Okay, now this is what we're going to do. And you know what? We need to make a circle, because it's going to be too hard if we're sitting like this. So how about everybody come over here? And this is a little bigger area, and we can all sit in a circle here. Before we start, let's do what we did yesterday and do a passing of the hand squeeze so that we all know our names, because I know everybody's names here, but I don't know if everybody else does. And it's very seldom that I actually do know everybody's names. I'm more likely to know everybody's stories than I am to know your name. Yeah, take a comfortable chair. Okay. Here we go. Right, put the stone in the middle now. And we'll just go around.
Okay.
Marin.
Viola.
Jereen.
Heidi.
Heather. Clary.
Marin again. All right. Now, in the best of times and the worst of times, feelings are moving. And what I want everyone to begin to recognize is that feelings or emotions, interesting word, move stories. They move people. They move you and they move your listener. And please don't avoid using feelings when you're telling stories. In some groups that I've worked with, these men would say, I just can't tell that story because I will cry. And I say, please do. You know, that is a powerful thing for a man to be so moved that tears come to his eyes. What a wonderful gift to share that with us. That sensibility, that humanity, that's important. So, now, I learned from the same person that taught me to know what I know and know that I know it. That is the fellow who played Beaver and Beaver to Beaver. In Beaver to Beaver.
Leave it.
Leave it to Beaver. And Leave It to Beaver. Yeah, he was teaching an acting class in LA and I was visiting my sister and I went to it. And he also gave this information. We all have a huge panoply of emotions that's running through us at all times. But in the process of socialization and education, we've been taught to deny, repress, control, ignore those feelings. Now, you can access those feelings in several different ways. Stanislavski actually did it with going back to an experience and recovering that experience that makes you feel a certain way. Well, that's what the method actors were doing until television came along. And then when television came along, they had to have that feeling now. There wasn't any messing around. Mm-hmm. you couldn't go back in the wings and prepare. Well, what happened was that they discovered they had them and they could do it. But it helps to have been through it. So this exercise will help us to acknowledge these feelings and not feel like they're not to be expressed, right? Okay. And we're carrying our ancestor stone here, which gives us permission to be who we are, right? Okay. Now, the first thing to do is to be able to not express any feelings at all. The classic Norwegian man. Or perhaps even more so, let's go even farther and play robot. Okay? No social, nothing nice, no smiling now, Journey. It's just neutral. And what we're going to do, and I'll demonstrate with Clary, I'm going to pass this stone and I'm going to say, this is a stone. And then you say, this is a what, and give it back to me.
This is a what?
This is a stone. Now you say, this is a stone, and give it to Heather.
This is a stone.
This is a what?
No, no, neutral. You're inquisitive, you're a little worried.
Okay.
You're wondering.
Okay. This is a what?
This is a stone.
This is a stone.
This is a what?
This is a stone.
This is a stone.
This is a what?
This is a stone.
This is a stone.
This is a what?
This is a stone.
This is a stone.
This is a what?
This is a stone.
Excellent work, everybody. All right, neutral position. Important place to know when you're telling a story, giving a presentation, singing a song, acting, doing anything in front of anyone. This is a place of power, a place of safety, and you have permission at any time to return to neutral. You can take a rest, you can pause and go forward, or pick up something that you might have forgotten from before, where you leave off. Or you can just go into neutral and continue your story in neutral. All right? That's one choice you can make. Here's another. This, I'm going to say the same words, pass it this way this time so we don't get sick to our stomach going around in the same direction. And I am going to give this to you with a feeling. You will know this feeling, and you will catch it from me. And you will express the same feeling and pass it to Jereen with the same words, back and forth that we did for neutral. All right? All the way around. Okay. This is a stone. Now give it back to me and say, this is what? This is a what?
This is a what?
Oh, this is a stone!
This is the stone.
This is a what?
This is a stone.
This is a stone.
This is a what?
This is a stone.
This is a stone.
This is a what?
It's a stone.
This is a stone.
stone. This is a stone.
This is a what?
This is a stone. I got goose pimples.
That was fun. Okay, now you can see how that could be funny as well as scary, right? Okay, next one. This is a stone.
This is a what?
This is a stone.
This is a stone. This is a what? This is a stone. This is a stone.
Ah, this is a what?
This is a stone.
This is a stone.
This is a what?
It's a stone.
This is a stone. This is a stone.
This is a stone.
This is a what?
This is a stone.
Now, often, fear is the hardest emotion for men to show, and rage is the hardest emotion for women to show. Isn't that interesting? You can think about that.
So what were we just doing? Fear or rage?
Right. You don't know? Were you faking it?
We had some fear in there.
How dare you? This is a stone.
This is a stone.
And they can be used for the good or the bad, depending. We've been dealing with some stories in the village recently that have been disturbing, you know? And a lot of feelings have been stirred up around them.
Can you spend a little more time on the neutral? That was interesting to me. Something new that I hadn't really thought about, because I always, whenever I get up, try to smile, you know, that sort of thing.
All right. Well, the thing about neutral is that neutral is when you are not in a dependent relationship with anything. You are standing, you are in yourself, you are in touch with what is within. You're in the inner, what I like to call the inner verse, as opposed to the universe. And there's a lot inside of you, right? And we all kind of know this instinctively. Each person carries worlds within them. But we deny it. Because it's not really useful to act on that information, normally speaking. But when somebody's in neutral, we can't help but recognize this person is on their own. They are strong. They are not in a vulnerable place. And, you know, I was teaching the standing position to a group of junior high school kids. Some boys, some young boys were in the class. And the standing position is just the same as the sitting position, with your feet directly parallel under your shoulders, and you just stand. That's it. And they said, this is the first position in all the martial arts. So the next group that I was with was a group of tour guides from the convention center in Minneapolis. And I said, and this is neutral position, a good position to begin anything with, and it is the first position in all the martial arts. Not a bad idea, though, if you're having some kind of a conflict with somebody very significant to you, to take neutral position. It's a strong position to be in. If you're in a negotiating kind of a situation, or if you're needing to ask to listen to something that you don't want to hear or that you don't like, go to neutral. Go to neutral. Don't cringe. Go to neutral. It is a place of composure. Even if you don't feel it, you will emit that sensation to people. And to begin the day in neutral, I like doing it. And then sometimes I do a little yoga also, or meditation. When we did the first eye opener, that's what we did. We just did a breathing exercise. And then we went on to do some other things with the stones and the pearly everlastings. But whatever we're doing, let's think today about the worst or the best of times. And just take a moment in neutral, close your eyes, and let's just come to a place or a picture in our minds that we'd like to share with us. And as you share this image, which is maybe more than an image, it might be a story, do it with this consciousness of the feelings that it is evoking in you and us, right? Or maybe you'd like to think about, instead of a picture or a scene, you might think of a feeling that you had, a strong one of these basic feelings, a very strong feeling. And where were you and what was happening at the time when you were so angry or so happy or so frightened or so sad? And when you're ready, just open your eyes. And let us also remember that we want to use our diaphragms when we're talking in here so that everybody can hear us. All right? And I'm going to pass the stone to someone who opened her eyes first.
But I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do.
Just tell a story about a strong feeling or about an image. You could tell a story about your daughter going home.
I'm going to tell my daughter's story.
Yes, do. Mm-hmm.
We left Africa in 1971. Kari was almost 8. Sonia was almost 12. In 2005, their cousin was in Nairobi, and he invited them to come to Africa. This is almost 35 years later. And one of the things they did is they went to our old house. When they got there, a black man came out of the home, and my nephew greeted him in Swahili, and the man laughed and said, "I don't understand you. I'm from London." And the home we had lived in was now a hostel for doctors who were studying tropical medicine at the hospital. Well, the girls told him they had lived there and grown up there as children. And he maybe was a little wondering, is this really so? So he had them describe the inside of the house, and of course they knew it exactly. They were invited in for tea, and then they were shown around the house. And while they were being shown around, the cook was making rice and chicken. So they ate rice and chicken. When it was time to leave, this same man from London walked out with them, and he said, "I sit here out on the porch in the evening and often wonder who had lived here before. Was it a family?" And he said, "Then out in the lawn, I see 4 children." He had no way of knowing there were 4 children. "I see 4 children, and then when the father comes home, he takes the little one and puts the little one on his shoulders." And both girls burst into tears and said, "Our spirits stayed here." Isn't that amazing?
My story takes place in Stehekin through writing and verbal discussion. My husband and I found ourselves there because it ended 8 years of trying to have kids. And I've got emotions. So we've gone through all the fertility counseling and tried to find out why, and we found out why we couldn't get pregnant. The two of us both had issues. And so then we had to come to a solution of going on with more in vitro, or adopting, or taking our life as it was. And so we went to a safe place, which was Stehekin, to think about this. And we wrote a letter to our child that we couldn't have, and read it to each other. And then in the next Mother's Day, this was in the fall, on the next Mother's Day, I didn't want to be around any mother stuff. And because we decided not to adopt and just to devote ourselves to our nieces and nephews, which we have 32 of them between our two families. And so we went our separate ways to think about this, because here it was 6 months later. And I went out to this favorite little spot, and there was a little red wagon sitting there on this little spit. And it's a place where I was going to paint in my journal. There was a mother goose with like little goslings on her back, and this little red wagon with beautiful mountains. And Pat came up to find me, and he said, "Did you put that wagon there?" And he's like, "No, it was there." And it was like a gift from God to say, "This is okay that you don't have kids, but they're important to us." And at that place, is this rock, and I carry it with me. It's a carving of the scene, and then on the back is the name we were going to give our children. So And through, there was all the emotions went through: sadness, fear, anger, happiness, for all those times. And we've kind of settled down, but it's still there. That was 1996, so 13 years ago.
I'm having trouble reading the name.
Name is Keegan.
Keegan. It's
and when
it's
I got
Celtic.
Up here, yeah, I heard someone talking about a Keegan girl.
Maybe.
Somebody. I heard someone talking about a friend named Keegan.
Yeah.
And Pat and I got off the bus and we were hearing that. Keegan's here. So. Okay, that's my story.
It's a beautiful story. Thank you.
It's with the rock.
Well, this has conjured up so many different possibilities as each one talks that I don't know where to begin. And it's tough.
I know it.
You've got so many stories you want to tell.
I know.
Where do you start? So, well, this is kind of follow up on yours, I guess, that conjured up this situation. I grew up enjoying the book Heidi. And I'm so glad to have you here, because you'll find out why in just a minute. And so therefore I always swore I would have a daughter named Heidi. And it was 9 years by choice before we decided to have a family. And we had done a lot of traveling and going to graduate school and what have you. So when I did get pregnant after some tries, I just hoped and prayed it would be a little girl. And then when I was going through the pregnancy, I said to the doctor, "Are you sure there aren't two in there? Because Heidi and Peter would be nice." since I waited so long, you know, just do it one
time.
but Heidi was born, Heidi Marie. And she looked the part of Heidi with the blonde hair and what have you. So things went along. Well, unbeknown to us, Heidi wasn't really happy with her name. Because I don't know just why, if people kind of Heidi ho-ho or just what. And she became a lawyer. And evidently she married somebody named Bruneman. And Heidi Bruneman, as a lawyer to her, evidently didn't sound right. And then she wasn't so sure about, she went through this period of time where she wasn't so sure about her life that she had with us, and she was really kind of, I don't know if her hormones were off or what, but she was going through something. So she decided that she would change her name. And with her husband, Randy Bruneman, they're driving around in the hill country there and trying out different names, and finally she thought, "Oh, Savannah sounds nice." Savannah, and the grandmother's name was Elizabeth, and she was envious that a cousin had hit Elizabeth for a middle name. So she lets us know as parents that she now is legally Savannah Elizabeth Bruneman. And you can imagine what that did to the whole total family, the whole relationship, you know, what we went through. And so I thought, now here I am wanting to always have a Heidi.
And now
I have a Savannah. And how did I solve this problem? You won't believe what I did. We lived in a townhouse in Dallas, Texas, had a little small garden area. And I wrote her name on a piece of paper, and I went out into this patio area, and under a stone, I buried the name. And that's how I brought closure to Heidi Marie.
Aww.
And now that happened in 1999. And so by now it's very easy for the whole family to refer to her as Savannah. But that's the story of my Heidi.
Whoa, that is powerful.
Yeah.
Whoa. My sister's nickname is Peter.
Oh. What is your sister's name?
Lisa, but her nickname is Peter.
And this is Heidi.
Oh, Heidi.
So
Heidi and Peter.
Are you ready?
No, not yet.
Well, since the topic seems to be going to children.
A little bit louder now, by the way.
Yes.
I can't. You can. Why don't you sit next to her, because that might be a good idea.
Thank you.
And pull over. She has having a little voice problem.
No,
that's okay.
Ever since I was a little girl, I always thought of growing up to be a mother, my mother, grandmother, and just thought that that was what little girls did, was grow up and become mothers. And so I went to school, and well, I won't go into a lot of detail there about going to school. I did my lessons and tried to did what mother wanted, and then my parents said, well, as I got into my teen years in high school, some of the girls were, you know, and the boys were pairing off, but oh, my mother always said that these were boy crazy girls. You know,
boy, that being, was a
being,
term.
Being boy crazy, yeah, was bad. And when they would go and walk around town on that Saturday night and hold hands and so forth. And so I was afraid of doing any dating and so forth. And so I went on to school and did some office work, and then went into nursing during the World War II when they were calling for nurses. Can't go into a lot of detail in here, but and then after I was in nursing, felt called to be doing something Christian work, and brought up in the church and brought up to be a believer, and so I felt the need to get some more training. I went into Bible school, and I heard a lot about mission work, and also felt called to that. One thing that was difficult facing, well, if I went to the mission field, chances were getting pretty slim to ever get married and have a family. I thought about, but, you know, and to put God first. So that's what I did. I went on out, and then there were a couple of my friends out there actually did find someone and marry out there in the mission field. And that was kind of a hard to be happy for them, and yet kind of, well, couldn't that have been me?
Yeah.
But then, lo and behold, it did happen to me. After my doctor, who I'd been working with as a nurse out there, and his wife died after a tragic burn accident. Mm-hmm. I'll go into that, but moved out, and he had, they had three children who I'd known since we had left together. We left the States at the same time, and I would study together, and I had known the children as they were growing up. Now they were teenagers, and the youngest wasn't quite a teenager, but so we did develop our relationship, and got married there, and in fact, even became a mother out there in Madagascar. Had my first child, was born in Madagascar. In the nurse's home there. And I was very thrilled. And we came on home on furlough then when he was 6 weeks old. So I had built-in babysitters with the teenage daughters. And especially the youngest one was the best one with Carl. And so even though that marriage did end in divorce 10 years later, why, we still had two wonderful sons. I would have liked to have had a daughter sometime, but I have some great stepdaughters and step-grandchildren and step-great-grandchildren, besides my two sons having four daughters. Wow. Three in one family and oh. one in the other. So we've been the ups and downs, but it's a great life, and God's been with me the whole time.
Viola, thank you for sharing that.
Much time.
Come on, come on, Heidi. You could just share one incident in which you had a strong feeling.
I'm really reluctant to share because I've had a lot of anger this summer. Uh-huh. And you say it's really hard for girls to express anger. And it might be hard. I think for me it's hard to do it when I'm around people. But I run every single day, or 6 days a week.
You're just like my Heidi.
Yeah. And that's when it comes out. And I wear headphones every day to kind of forget about the anger. And it dealt mostly this summer, as it has for quite some time now, about a relationship I was in, or just about love and figuring out that love stuff, you know, and who do you end up with. And there is this one run in particular that I was so mad at. And my favorite run to do here is just to go straight down to Lucerne. Because just that physically running away from someplace and not having to have to turn around and come back to it, but just running away from it is such a great visual for me. And previously I was in a rut, and because I had been with this one person for 2.5 years, and yet there's this person here who is also falling in love with me, and just not feeling like I could be true to either one of them at that time, and just being really angry at this person and at this person and at this person the entire time. And I wore headphones to try to not be angry and just try to rise above it, and I couldn't, and I just had to face it. And I was angry, and the tears just started coming down. They felt hot on my face and still running so hard. You could feel the pounding on your feet and the pounding on your knees, and the breeze is coming through you, but you just keep running. And finally there is just screaming at God, like, what the heck is going on here? Why am I even here this summer? I did not want to feel angry. I did not want to have this kind of experience again. Why am I here? And it's just this popping out of an anger towards God, and just screaming. My fists were clenched just a tight grip, and just my fingernails actually left marks on my hands like that, because I was just so angry. And then by the time you get down to where the hill sign is down by the switchbacks, that's just when it started being left, started letting go of it. And it's as if every single switchback I went down, able to shed a little bit more off, because you're going so fast that the anger can't, just kind of washes off of you.
Yeah.
By the time you get down the lake, I felt neutral again. I think I still have. It still comes up every now and then. So that's my story.
It's a good story.
That's amazing.
Good imagery.
Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Circle.
This has been a really wonderful circle. Thank you so much, all of you, for sharing with me.
Thank you.
Say our prayer. Thank you, God, for this wonderful time, the worst of times and the best of times are all part of your story. Amen.
Amen. Go in peace.
Go in peace, serve the Lord. And serve lunch.
Thanks be to God.
Thanks be to God. Yes. Amen.
We will. This one church I go to in Austin, Texas, they close with, you know, the peace, the Lord be with you. I mean, go in peace and serve. Yeah. And the congregation answers, and we will.
There's at the camp that I worked at. We did that too. Yeah. We would do it with a huge Texan accent. And we will.
Well, that's another translation of the amen, but a more meaningful and formal way that we.
And Heidi, since you represent staff, well, are you going to be here this fall, or are you leaving?
I'll be here till November 1st.
Oh, well, you're here longer than Clary. Yeah. I'm going to give you charge of the stone. You can share charge with anyone else who's on staff. And it now is a member of the Holden Village community. It's been endowed with a lot of meaning. We have held our stories with its stories.
You know what?
Was it?
The adopted daughter, that was the other story I was going to tell, Native American, from the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota, Fort Yates. Fort Yates, North Dakota. And at Fort Yates there is this shape, this very shape of the stone, the Standing Rock. Mm-hmm. And it's the story of the squaw who refused to go, you know, the Sioux Indians are always on the move, always on the move. And she just said, I'm staying here. And the rest of them went off in Standing Rock.
Yeah, and she looks just like a
squaw.
Yeah,
she does.
Wow.
It's a good
work with the Sioux Indians in South Dakota.
Yeah.
Wow.
The Ogallas. The Ogallas, huh?
Yeah. No,
well, she's
the Sioux Indians.
She's anyway. That was going to be
what a good, well, wonderful, yeah, all right, Standing Rock. Yeah. Well, anyway, anytime anybody wants to play with
it's a beautiful stone.
Our ancestor stone,
really
let
pretty.
Them know they're very welcome. You can tell stories with it or just do still lives.
I'm kind of painting.
Yeah,
it shouldn't be
in
there.
It shouldn't be in
there. I run it, but I just don't. Yeah. Go there on the lot.
Because people aren't telling stories in the hike.
Or
they unless
tell
they come
on
back.
The story,
on
the trail.
Yeah,
like yesterday, we had so many people.
Yeah.
And I've been
hearing
stories
rock.
From people.
But
that isn't
the wrong
thing. I'll have to take a
there
picture
a
of that to show
when you
Sue.
Come back.
Yeah,
oh,
do.
Yeah.
Oh, do.
Yes.
In fact, do you want to take it outside and take a picture of it? Move it in. Oh, by the way, I.